Welcome to part two of the three-part teleseminar series entitled The Truth and Nothing But the Truth about starting, growing, and running a really successful law firm. In each of these three parts, we focus on a different topic. In the first part, the focus was about the benefits of having a business plan and how having a business plan really changed the lives and the businesses of our guests, each with a very successful law firm. This part, part two, we're going to focus on some of the, how shall I say this nicely, excuses, stories, justifications, rationalizations, the things we tell ourselves to stay where we are and to keep tolerating what we keep tolerating instead of taking action to change our business so that we can change our life. And I have three really great guests lined up who have agreed to talk about some of the stories and justifications and excuses that they made for why they didn't believe their law firm could be more successful, why they didn't believe their law firm could make more money, give them more freedom, and things like that. And what they think about those stories and excuses in hindsight now that their law firms are where they are and their lives are so much better. In part three, we're going to be focusing on how your personal life can become better as a byproduct of your law firm's growth and success. You know, too many lawyers, they stall out the growth of their law firm or they don't give their law firm the freedom to grow because of a very, very dangerous belief or a discouraging belief. It's just a bad belief that somehow having a more successful law firm will lead to having a less successful life. And it's quite the opposite. The more successful your law firm becomes, it gives you more freedom, it gives you more options, it gives you more resources and tools to live a better life. And we're going to be interviewing some really amazing lawyers tomorrow about that. But today, we are talking with Sarah Hobson. Hi, Sarah.
Hey, Arjun.
Hector Quiroga. Hector, you're with us?
Hi, Arjun. I'm here.
And Michael Bender. And I know Mike is
Hi,
here
Arjun.
Because you were here earlier. Hi, Mike.
Hi.
So let's do this in reverse order. We decided before the call that we're going to interview Sarah first, Hector second, and Mike third. So, Michael, I'm going to start with you and just ask you to introduce yourself, and then we'll have Hector introduce himself, and then Sarah can introduce herself, and we'll just roll right on into the conversation and the interview with her. So, Michael, would you please just the name of your firm, tell us about your partner. It's very unusual for us to have partners in how to manage a small law firm. We generally prefer to work with single shareholder, sole decision makers, but Michael and his partner really have a really unique relationship. So, Michael, tell us a little bit about your firm.
Well, John, I want to start by saying thanks for having me on this this podcast. Very honored that you've, you know, we've worked with you the last 2.5 years and seen tremendous growth. And it's just to have that you know, obviously seen from the outside is great. My name is Michael Bender. I am a partner at the Gray Legal Group here. My partner is Allison Tilton. We've been partners now for about 3.5 years, and we are a family law firm who fights for business professionals and, business owners and professionals to survive divorce and keep their money in their pocket and their kids at their side. Primarily practicing in, we practice in Southern California, mostly Riverside County. All areas of family law.
How long have you and Allison been in business together for?
We started this practice June of 2016. We had been working as associates together previously for about 3 years.
And did you both leave that firm to start this one together?
Yes, we did.
What caused you to make the decision to leave that firm and start this one together?
Well, it was an interesting situation. We were both working for my dad at the time, and the practice had really branched out into two different areas, one family law and one other area of law that really wasn't didn't work well, particularly in the marketing aspect of family law. So I kind of looked at the situation, you know, realizing where I wanted to go with my career and said, hey, if we're going to make this work, we've got to niche down and just do family law. So, my side of the story is I talked to Allison about it, and she basically said to me, well, if you're going to do this, we're doing it together, because she wanted to stay in family law. She didn't want to work for me, and we decided to partner up, and it's been a great partnership ever since.
And so when did you start the firm? In what part of 2016?
Well, it was in April of 2016 that I came back from a marketing conference with this this concept of, hey, I've got to really niche down. So I mulled on it over the next month. We made the decision in May that we were going to break away, start our own firm, just do family law. And then it was June 1st that we officially launched.
And did you take a bunch of clients with you, or did you start completely from scratch?
We were fortunate enough to be able to take the client base with us because, you know, we had been working with my father. He didn't want the family law litigation anymore. So he kept what the practice area that he was doing. We were able to start with a base of clients at the time.
Okay, well, that kind of goes into what kind of base of clients did you start with, and why did you think that was a good thing? From the tone of your voice, it makes me think that what you thought wasn't really how it turned out to be.
Well, it turned out to be great in the long run. The problem was we had this base of clients, we just didn't know what to do with them. At the time, you know, hey, we're great lawyers. We can figure this out ourselves. And we just tried to continue working on the cases, do what we thought we needed to do. And we didn't have any growth essentially for over a year. We just stayed stagnant. Well, we had a lot of clients. We thought we were in a great position.
And you were stagnant at about what revenue range?
Anywhere as far as the monthly, anywhere from 20 to 30,000 a month. There was a month that we were down at 14,000. The annual, basically, if I'm adding it up, it's probably in the 300 to 320 range.
Okay, and what kind of excuses did you make about why your law firm had to run that way, why you had to tolerate what you were tolerating, why you couldn't make changes to make things better? What kind of excuses were you making? And did you realize they were excuses at the time? I imagine not.
Oh, absolutely not. I would say we were immature in the fact that we thought we knew exactly how to do it. We had been trained a certain way to do certain things. Nothing was really systematized. We all just had in the back of our minds, this is how we typically do it. If we continue to do it, we can make it better, but we have to do it ourselves. We've got to be in there pulling all the levers, making sure this is happening, that's happening in every aspect of the business, which we didn't even know how many aspects of the business there were. We were still, this is a law firm. We have our clients. We need to service our clients, and we need to do it our way. We need to have our hands in everything.
And so what are some of the things that you look back at now and you realize they were just excuses? What you're describing were misunderstandings about the nature of the business of a law firm as compared to the practice of law. I want to drill more into things that you probably knew you should have done, but you didn't do them and you made an excuse, you justified, you rationalized. That's what I'm trying to focus in on.
As far as specifically what we didn't address or making up excuses were, you know, even looking at, you know, being able to look at it from a business perspective, not knowing what our numbers were. We didn't do that because our excuse was, oh, that's how a different that's not how law firms are run. Law firms, the excuse is you've got to specifically deal with the client. Your responsibility is to the client as the owner. You are the lawyer. You've got to do everything here to make sure that that client is being taken care of. You don't need to worry about all the business stuff.
So you knew better, but you told yourself those things to let yourself off the hook. That's
absolutely
what I'm understanding.
You tell yourself, hey, I'm a great lawyer. I mean, every lawyer out there thinks that they're the greatest lawyer, and clients should come flocking to them, because if they go to somebody else, they're going to get a worse experience. You can always do better than the lawyer. And our excuse was, hey, if we just lawyer better, the business is going to come, the money is going to come, the growth is going to come. We just figured, keep trudging down that path, and like I said, it was just stagnant.
So the definition of the word excuse is to justify, to release.
Correct.
From an obligation, to seek to remove blame. So what are some things that you knew you should have done that you said things to remove to remove blame for yourself, to justify not doing, to try to release yourself from the obligation of doing that you really knew better? So, in other words, I don't presume that there's anyone listening to this podcast. I expect there's, in any given week, hundreds, in any given month, thousands of lawyers all over the country, solo and small law firm owners with all different practice areas, men and women, all different ages. And I don't presume that any of them don't know that they should have a written business plan. I don't think that any of them don't know that having a business plan would make their law firm work better. I don't presume that any of them don't know that they should have a budget. I think that they all know that, all things being equal, a law firm that's run with a budget is going to be more profitable and cause the owner to have less stress, and they'll be able to make better, quicker, faster, more objective, rational decisions. I don't presume that there's any lawyer listening to this who doesn't already know that a law firm being run with written job descriptions, where everyone on the staff clearly understands what's their job, how their job is supposed to get done, the standards that they should be doing their job to, and things like that. I don't presume that anyone listening to this doesn't already know that they should have these things in place. And yet they don't. And the reason they don't is because they make an excuse. So what were some of the things you knew that you should do, but you didn't do? And then what were the excuses you made to not do them?
When it gets down to the nuts and bolts of how things progress through the office, how you're preparing the file, how you're preparing the documents to get filed with the court and so forth. Yeah, they should have been written down. But the excuse was, oh, I'm going to be doing this anyways. I'm the one that is going to be walking to the fax machine to fax file with the court. I don't need to write this down. I don't need to worry about anybody else doing this because I'm going to be doing it. And even when things weren't done how you wanted them to get done, I'd still get upset, but I would just – the excuse was, oh, I just have to do this myself. Nothing was really written down in the beginning. It was just, this is how we've always done it. We're going to show you how to do it once, and you should figure it out after the fact, and you've got to do it the right way.
So when the staff was fumbling over themselves and not getting the job done the way you wanted the job done, and you were watching them get paid but not be productive, you justified continuing to tolerate that. How?
There was obviously some frustration with it. But the justification was, I just have to show them how to do it again. It really just didn't, it wasn't, let me put it down in writing so you can reference this in the future. It's just, if you're going to do it how I want to do it, I got to keep showing you over and over again until you do it the right way.
Okay. And let's shift focus. How long did you run your law firm before you reached out for someone to help you with how to manage the business side of it?
We got through the holidays. I mean, this is probably 7 months in. So January 2017, we had our worst month ever. This is when we were down about $14,000, and we're just sitting there. We're not getting paid. We're looking at the bills going, how are we going to do this? We're scratching our heads going, okay, there's got to be something out there. We got to be doing it. We knew that we had a marketing conference coming up, which I had gone to previously, that I had remembered that there were various vendors there that could help us with that. But we decided, you know what, we're just going to keep trudging along for the next 3 months. Let's go to that conference and find somebody there. So fortunately, in April, we were able to head out to this conference, and we interviewed How to Manage was there, and a couple other vendors. And really, we just got down to the nuts and bolts of what is it that we need. And we went in with the knowledge that we needed help, and we needed to find somebody that was going to be able to help us, point us in the right direction, pull us out of this hole that we were quickly digging ourselves into. And even still, when we recognized it a couple months prior, we were still digging ourselves into that hole.
So, you know, you guys are sort of an anomaly because you didn't make a lot of excuses, right? You started the firm, and pretty quickly, in less than the first year, you acknowledged we need some help. And then you immediately created a plan to attend that conference. And for everyone who's wondering, it's the AVO conference. That was the AVO conference, right? Lawyer Nomic.
Well, it was, yes, it was. I wasn't sure if you want me to
yeah,
to plug anybody else.
Lawyer Nomic conference. You went to the lawyer. You made a plan pretty quickly to go to the Lawyer Nomic conference with the definite intention of interviewing different people who presume to be able to tell you how to make your law firm better. And
correct.
You met us. You met some others. We won't mention the others. Not because I'm afraid of people knowing, but I just don't want to make it seem as if they're not good people or that they don't have good services. It's just some people like chocolate, some people like vanilla. You people are obviously into butter pecan with coconut shavings and a Kit Kat bar mixed in. Otherwise, you wouldn't be with me, right?
Absolutely.
The point I'm trying to make is you guys didn't really make a lot of excuses, and I think that's why you're having such a hard time answering this question, because here I am asking you, what excuses did you make to continue tolerating and putting up with and suffering with all these things that you that so many lawyers spend so many years and even decades of their lives putting up with? And really, your story is not a story of two people who made a lot of excuses. Your story is a story of people who, as soon as you realize that you needed to do something differently, you took action. You realized you weren't happy working at your dad's firm, and so you took action. You launched a different firm. You realized that the firm wasn't working the way you were trying to run it because you didn't know anything about the business of running a law firm, and so you took action. You attended a conference to find someone to help you. You met us, and you didn't make a whole bunch of excuses. You took action. You engaged our services, and that was 2 years ago. And every step of the way, as far as I remember, over the last 2 years, you guys have been action takers, not excuse makers.
Absolutely.
So I realize why you're having such a hard time answering this question.
Well, I wouldn't say it's not necessarily excuse. I mean, just because it happened within a short period of time, it doesn't mean there weren't excuses being made. I think we had the mindset of we're great lawyers. People are going to come to us. It's just going to take time. We're going to tolerate what's going on. And then eventually it was our revenue was just so low. We had nothing coming in. We sat down and said, we got to do something about this.
How old are you?
How old am I? 42.
Yeah. And how old is Allison?
Trick question. 38. I think. Yeah, she just turned 38.
All right. And how old are your kids?
My kids are 15, 12, and 9.
and hers.
9 and
older or younger
6.
Than 9?
No, yeah, I think 6.
Okay.
She's going to listen to this, and she's going to kill me for not knowing.
I didn't ask you, like, her kids' names that you didn't know. I mean, you're allowed
okay,
to not know
you.
The exact age of her kid, you know? Around 6 is good enough. They all look around the
around
six,
six, we'll
7, 5. They're like... So the point I'm making is, see, from your perspective, you waited a long time because you waited, like, a year or 6 months. You got to understand that I'm used to running into people who have been banging their head against the wall for a decade. You get what I'm saying?
Absolutely. And I mean, I could
so
even
from my standpoint, push. So from my standpoint, someone who makes a decision and within 3 months later is taking action, that's pretty good, you know, especially when they have, when they're waiting for a conference that, you know, it's not like you can just snap your fingers and the conference appears. You gotta
right.
go to the conference. Speaking of the conference, so let's change gears, because something interesting happened a year, or was it 2 years after you first engaged our services when you met us at that Lawyer Novice conference? Was it 1 year or 2 years later that you came and you volunteered to work in the booth with us?
Oh, my goodness. The booth was the following year. Yeah, we did it because it was 2017. We found out about it, and it was June of 2018. When we went and did the booth, correct.
Okay, so just to put some things in perspective for everyone who's listening to this, and I know they're going to want to know, revenues in the first full year were around $300,000.
Correct.
In the second year, which was your first year of us working together, what happened to revenues?
The first full year of us working together, I'm going from basically we started July of 2017. So basically August of 2017 to August of 2018, we went up to 493. Correct.
So an extra almost $200,000.
Correct.
All right. And then the next year?
From August 2018 to July 2019, just over 1 million.
So basically in 2 years, you more than tripled the firm.
Correct.
Are you working three times as hard? Do you have one-third as much free time? Do you have three times as many problems and headaches in your life, like most people think?
There were some growing pains, and there's been a lot of development, particularly within the last year, to be able to work more effectively. But no, I'm less stressed now than I was when I was sitting there on discovery day going, how am I going to pay for this?
And let's go back to that Lawyernomic conference that you visited 1 year after you began working with us. The firm has now grown by almost 100%. Like, it's grown by like 75% in the first year. I'm doing the math right.
Right.
So it's grown by about 75% in the first year. You come back, you volunteered to help us out at the booth to talk to the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of lawyers who came by the booth to talk to us.
Correct.
What kind of excuses did you hear from them? Maybe that would be easier to answer.
Okay. One of the biggest excuses I know somebody that I was talking with was a particular type of lawyer. I honestly cannot remember the exact type of lawyer, but let's just say it was a bankruptcy lawyer. And they wanted to know, well, does this work for
my practice
lawyer? My practice area. How do you know that, you know, I'm a good bankruptcy lawyer. This is how I've been doing it. No, I haven't had any growth, yada, 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 but why should I look at it this way? Why should I be looking at the seven parts of the business? Why? How is this going to apply? Why should I be looking at it as a business as opposed to I have to grow my practice? And it was just they thought they were so unique in their area of practice that they just, you know, put blinders on. It was, you know what? I'm just going to keep doing it the way I'm doing it because I know how to be a good area of practice, bankruptcy lawyer, and that's what's going to help me grow. That's what's going to help me grow, become a more profitable business.
Okay, come on. You stood at that booth for 2 days. You talked to like 200 lawyers who came by and told you reason after reason after reason why they were going to continue to stay stuck. They told you their problems. They told you what was going on in their law firm. You told them that you just grew your law firm 75% in the last 12 months. And they said to you, yeah, but here's my reason why I'm not going to do anything. What were some of those excuses?
I'm not at a stage in my career that I can do that. I've got to focus on this. I've got to they didn't want to acknowledge the fact that they did have the time. I don't have the time to do that. I'm too busy doing something else. Or they even tried to convince themselves that they could do it themselves.
All right. I've been asking this question to people a lot lately. If we could get you into a time machine and get you and Allison back to the beginning of 2016 when you made the decision to start your own law firm, what do you imagine that conversation would sound like? What would you tell the younger you two, and what do you think the younger you two would say to the two of you who just stepped out of the time machine and said, let me tell you how it is?
I'm sorry, I didn't follow the question. What would the 2016
you and Allison
Mike
get in
Allison
a time machine?
Say?
You okay. And Allison get in a time machine. We go back and we visit the two of you at the beginning of 2016. The today version of you step out and say to the younger version of you, "Hey, listen, this is what you need to do." What do you think they would have said? Do you think they would have just said, okay, thanks for giving us the information, now we know we'll do it? Or do you think they would have resisted some things?
Absolute resistance. There still would have been a lot of immaturity. I've already used that word, but I think there would have been some immaturity as far as no way or why did it take so long? If that's the magic pill, you know, thinking that that's going to be the magic pill, why did it take so many years to do it? Why couldn't you do it right off the bat? And without the understanding that there is a process, there is the growth that needs to happen. It's not just going to happen overnight. I think there was an expectation back in 2016. You stepped out. This is the first real business that we had run. And there was the thought, hey, we're going to step right into this. It's going to be successful right away. All my money problems are going to go away. I'm going to be, the greatest attorney out there that everybody's coming to, and our practice is going to be extremely profitable within that year. I still think it would have just been the skepticism of, well, this doesn't seem like I can do this. You know, what's going to take so long?
What have been some of the best business moves you've made in growing your business? And I'm not fishing for, we hired How to Manage a Small Law Firm. Real tactics, real things that people listening to this can do. What were like some of the best things you did that you maybe wish you had done sooner to grow your business?
Hired the right people and delegated. Honestly, that's been one of our biggest, actually at least one of the biggest things that I've seen. Again, I kind of go back to the beginning. I can do this all myself. I can, you know, if it's not done my way, it's not done the right way. Stepping back, and if there's somebody that's competent to do it, and this could be in any type of task within the business, giving an example right now, earlier today, I had a meeting with my intake team. And I would say three years ago, I wouldn't have used the word intake and known all that type of stuff. But, you know, 2 years ago, I would have said, okay, I have this system. I need to sit there, play with everything. I need to set it up. This is how it's going to look. Well, we sat down. We're going through some new policies and procedures that are going to be implemented. I delegated. I said, I've got some other things that I have to spend my time on. I asked somebody, can you create this form? Can you modify what we talked about today? Can you figure this out? Come back to me. We're meeting later this afternoon and going to make sure everything's ironed out. But in the past, I would have just said, I've got to do it. When it comes to the legal work, we've fortunately been able to hire some associate attorneys. And being able to step back and focus on other areas of the business while they're doing a lot of the legal work has just been phenomenal.
What excuses do you imagine that the old you would have had if the new you went back and said, you got to start delegating, you got to hire great people, you can't hire the cheapest person, you got to hire the best person, all the things you just told me?
Still the excuse, if it's not going to get done the right way, you got to do it yourself. It's just that mindset of, it's, I'm the only one, I have this vision of how it needs to get done, therefore I'm the only one that can get it done, whether it's building the intake system or litigating a case or creating some type of procedure for a workflow. It was, I know how I want this to get done. If I let it to somebody else, they're going to screw it up.
How would you compare the client experience that your clients have today working with the firm as you're operating it now compared to the way you operated the firm 2 years ago?
Well, we had 2 years ago, it was just Alice and myself. We had a part-time assistant, and we were literally in the thick of everything, doing everything. Today, we've got two associates, a paralegal, two legal assistants, what we call a client relations manager, and a billing assistant. The client experience is leaps and bounds better than what it was before. You had to talk to us previously. If we had the time, we had to make the time, and we were sometimes frustrated about, hey, it's getting at 4:55. I've got to run out to get to my kid's game or get to practice or pick them up or go have family time. But there's the frustration level that you've still got to be in the office working on everything. Now when a client calls in, there's somebody to talk to. They can get updates on their case. If it's something that the paralegal can't help with, we'll get back to them because the paralegal is going to talk to the associate, or the associate talks to us. There's so much more information and so many more people right now that the client can talk to get a better client experience than they could when it was just Allison and myself fielding everything.
You think most lawyers would agree with that conclusion, that having a staff gives the client a better experience, or do you think most lawyers that you know think the client wants their sweat and their fingerprints and their saliva on every single postage stamp?
There's a significantly high percentage of lawyers out there that will say, the client hired me, I need to be the one talking with them, I need to give them everything, or else they're not going to want to work with me anymore. They're not going to want to pay their bill. It has to be me. I think that is a very pervasive thought throughout the industry.
Do you think that's what they really believe, or do you think that's just an excuse they use to avoid something?
I do think there's a part of them that truly believes that. But I also think it's an excuse as far as not wanting to take on the additional risk, what they could see as risk of bringing people in to better their clients' cases and better their clients.
If you had something to say to lawyers out there who will be listening to the podcast who might be making excuses to avoid doing what they know they need to do to make their business better, Any words of wisdom?
I think those who are trying to make excuses right now, they need to get educated. Not that they need to find some seminar and figure out how to do all this stuff, but get the education. Talk to talk to those who have been successful, not the people who are making the same excuses day in and day out, but figure out why somebody has started to delegate, why somebody has grown their firm, how they've done it, and understand that they are just feeding themselves excuses. And
Mike,
once they can,
thank you for go ahead.
No, go. That's about the best I can stay on the spot.
I wasn't trying to rush you off stage. I thought you were done. I'm sorry. I was thanking you for your time.
There's the music. All right, I'm out of here.
Sorry. All right. I just realized I completely screwed up the order of this. You were supposed to go last. Well, that's what happens when you don't have a script, right? When you're just having a conversation, which is really what I wanted this to be, is more of a conversation and not just like a scripted thing. So, Sarah, Hector, either of you want to go next?
Okay, you can go next.
Thank you, Sarah. Hector.
Yeah. All right. Well, I am Hector the Protector, and I help immigrants like myself get a green card and being out of detention.
And when did you start your own law firm?
We started in 2009.
And what did you do before you had your own law firm?
I went to law school.
So law school, bam, start your own law firm.
Right.
All right. And, you know, I just realized that the three of you are the worst guests we could have chosen for this podcast. Well, because listen to this, right? This whole episode was supposed to be about the excuses that you made, and you know the whole idea was that you were gonna say, yeah, and I realized I made those excuses, and I wish I hadn't made those, and blah blah blah,
yeah.
And I regret all those excuses that I made. But I just realized Hector is like the king of no excuses. Mike, you just heard a story about he doesn't make excuses. They realize they need to do something. Bam, they do it. 3 years later, they go from a $200,000 law firm to a $1 million law firm. Hector, you want to talk just briefly about what it took for you to get into law school, much less out of law school, much less, you know, to say nothing of where you're at now?
Right.
I mean, this is like no excuse. This is like no excuse Tuesday.
Right. So. So I came to the States in 2000, and so what happens is I didn't speak English, and I couldn't. I had just graduated high school, and so I'm from Colombia, and so in Colombia you go to law school straight from high school. You go 5 years to law school, but that's it. You're a lawyer. So I always knew I wanted to be a lawyer, and I was kind of found that I had to have an undergraduate degree before I can go to law school. So then I say, well, I know I want to be a lawyer. I just have to have this undergraduate degree, so fine. I taught myself some English and took some classes in English. In about 6 months, I was able to enroll into an academic program to go on to undergraduate. So I went to a community college for a couple of years. Then I graduated in 2004 with a bachelor's degree in economics and political science. The reason why I picked this school was because I thought that to transfer from this undergraduate school to the law school would be a lot easier if you went to the same school. That's literally the reason why I picked up the law school I went to. But then my woes with the LSAT began because I graduated top of my class. I was an academic scholar. I had a lot of scholarships. I did very well in undergrad. But when I went to apply for the law school, I was denied, and I was denied about seven times because my LSAT score was low. So what happened is I spent a lot of money. I had private tutoring. I tried to do the best I could, financing my own education to try to increase my score. And every year or every time the exam would come around, my score would actually go either be the same or go down. I never was able to really get it up there. So through this application process, I appealed, I presented my pitch, and then they told me, look, we are very concerned with your English, right? You may not pass the bar exam. You may not make it through law school because we think your English isn't good enough. Certainly it's not good enough for the LSAT. So that really irritated me because they just had taken, I think it was about $120,000 on student loans to graduate with an economics degree, and this is the same school telling me maybe my English isn't good enough. So it irritated me, it really pissed me off. So I told them, listen, I will graduate from this school, and I will I will make this a reality. I had a denial letter on my hands, and I just remember the dean of admissions telling them, listen, if I will graduate, I will be a lawyer, and I will frame this letter next to my degree. And that was kind of my attitude. So I went back in. I said, okay, clearly it's not the LSAT. I had met my wife in undergrad, and she, her and I just studied together for the LSAT, and she got in first try, and I didn't. And so it was very frustrating because when I looked at all of it, I look at her answers. We took the exam. We were in the same room together. I went down through it, and it really all turned out to be like she had 5 questions better than I did. That's it. And in a 180 question exam, she had 5 better than I did, and that was what made the difference between in or out. So I figured that I probably couldn't get, like I had tried for so long, that I needed a different approach. And so I ended up getting enrolled in a four-tier school in Michigan, which allowed me in. And I went into that law school, Thomas Cooley School of Law in Michigan. And Cooley's motto is kind of like, unspoken motto is like, easy to get in, but difficult to stay in. So they at the time, at least, it was 50% of the class was academically dismissed. So it's almost like they let you in, and it was, at the time at least, and I think they might do it now, you could actually put your stats online, and they'll tell you if you are accepted before you even apply. Okay? That's what happened back then. I said, look, I got to go to law school. So I told my wife, we had 2 kids, I have to do this. I have to leave you here. Because I got to get in. She was already starting her 2nd year when I was, like, leaving. So I went to law school, and 1st year came, and I did extremely well. I rocked the house. I was straight A's to the point that Cooley came back to me and said, hey, Hector, we're going to give you a 75% academic scholarship to stay. But I wanted to graduate from the school, and then, of course, I have family, so I had to come back to Spokane, to Gonzaga, and that's the reason why I said, no, I'm walking in. So I then apply now as a transfer student, and I said, look, you worry about my English. I have straight A's, including contracts, property, you know, the 1st year classes. At that point, it's like, you really have to let me in, right? And Gonzaga then oblige and allow me to come back in. And so I came back into the school, and, you know, 2 years later, I graduated top of my class from that school. I have opened 3 law firms. Well, I have opened 1 law firm with 3 different locations. And in every single conference room, you'll see my degree with the copy of the denial letter next to it. So,
I love that story. I love that. Yeah. That's just such a great story.
It
just really puts in
perspective. I teach at the law school. So they come by later and call me that you teach. And so they put a tile in the law school. When you come in, you have my name on it. So it's really, yeah. But it was a lot about, I don't necessarily with excuses. It's just like, I want this. It's a yes or yes. You know, I just, you know. So
So you started your own law firm in 2009, and just run us through the revenues if you as best you can. And not that revenues are the only measure of success. It's just an easy thing to measure, and that's why we talk about it.
Right. So we the way this worked is that Casey then graduated about a couple of years ahead of me. So she went to be an associate, and she was working as an associate while I was coming behind, and I told her, "Han, we can do this, right?" Perhaps naive or not, I think it was probably the right thing. You don't come to America to, you see the opportunity. You mean I can just file for a business license and I can be in business? Is like that easy? Yes, I'm like, I don't have to bribe anybody. I don't have to, like, do anything weird like that. No, okay. So I told her we got to do this. And so it was very interesting because I studied for the bar exam while I was building my own desk in my own office that had my name on the door, right? Obviously, Casey's on an opening. So the first year, we lost like $20,000 into this, right? It was a lot of investment. We opened right in January, and then we kind of went like negative. Then the year after, revenues was about $130,000 or so. The third year, we went to like $200,000. The third year it was like $210,000. Fourth year was like $230,000. Fifth year was like $238,000. We were definitely stacked on those 3 years. Like we couldn't seem to break that point for us. And my excuse for why is I was raised with, you know, you don't make excuses. What you do is you work your ass off. You work. It's just work ethic, pure discipline and work ethic. The problem was that I just sat down with my schedule and I looked at it and I go, I can't possibly work one more hour. There isn't one more hour. Like I'm working top capacity. I am. I'm 10 years younger than I am. I'm 37 years of age, so I was 27. I was giving it every single moment, thought, and I just couldn't get a hold of this thing. Like, literally, I was just like, I don't know what else to do, right, to market my practice and to do what I needed to do. We had a family, and so that's what shift I had was, if I can give it more time or more effort, because, you know, there is so many hours. There's only 90 hours in a week, right? I was putting so much time into the firm, I thought, obviously, I'm doing something wrong, right? And for a good period of time, I think the last couple of years, it was a lot of blaming. Law school lied to me, right? I thought this was going to be there, but I thought the big offers were going to come after I graduated from law school, right? If you graduated top of your class, the offers were going to come in. They, you know, of course, I didn't apply anywhere, so I don't know. But I was kind of, I got filled with bitterness, right?
So blame is a kind of an excuse, right?
Yeah.
It's not my fault. It's someone else's fault. My excuse is that it's someone else's responsibility.
Yeah.
So blame was your excuse for something.
It was, and I victimized a lot of myself. I was like, oh, you know, the student loans, and, you know, there was this interest rate, and I just, what mistake did I make? And then I would go to bar association meetings, right? And the bar, it was this university of discouragement. Everybody was, oh, the market is terrible, and my client is this, and I did, you know, my client didn't pay my bill, and look at all this work that I did. And it was just kind of like seeming the same, where it just became that. And at that point, we're at 250. I mean, it's two lawyers full-time working, so this is revenues. We are bringing about $30,000 to the house, right? We were doing a lot of bankruptcy work at the time, and I had bankruptcy clients who would come to us who would make double the amount that we were making, and they were complaining about their life. And we were going, something is really wrong here, right? And so that's when So what happened is we needed to get our CLE credits in. And Arjun and your team were coming through Spokane, and literally we picked the CLE. Casey picked the CLE literally because it was the cheapest. We didn't even care what it was. We actually picked it because of the price, because it was the cheapest that we could find to get our credits. It just happened to, this was all of this information that she came back and said, you gotta really look at this. And that was the first time I was like, okay, obviously I'm doing it wrong. I'm working a lot. Nobody, everybody here is blaming the market. Something is wrong, right? Maybe I can listen. Do you mean somebody's teaching how to manage this thing? So that's kind of how we ended up getting involved with How to Manage, and we've been with you working with How to Manage since 2014, right?
2014.
Right. It was May of 2014 when we joined, and then...
So 2009, yeah. You lost $20,000.
Right.
2010 was 130. 2011 was 200. 2012
right.
was 210.
Right.
2013 was 230.
Right.
2014 was 238.
Correct.
And we've been working together since when? With my team?
Yeah, May.
So you started working with my team sort of the middle or the end of 2014.
Right.
Okay. And 15, 16, 17, 18, what does that look like?
All right. So in 15, the first year, we actually got like 320. 16, we got to like 580. 17, we got to 1.2. 18, that was 2.1. And we'll close 3.1 this year.
And this year, you were named by Inc. Magazine as one of the 5,000 fastest growing companies in the entire country, not just law firms, companies in the entire country.
That's correct.
What was your ranking in Inc. Magazine?
1137. So
the 1,137th fastest growing company in the country, according to Inc. Magazine, with revenues going from losing $20,000, $130,000, $200,000, $200,000, $200,000, $200,000, kind of stuck in that 200 to 238 range. Then you pop up to 320, 580, 1.2, 2.1, and $3 million. What? I mean, I can't even ask you what excuses you made because you didn't make it, right? You just took action. So I guess my question is, what excuses do you find around you when you talk to struggling lawyers? You go to bar functions, you go to CLE events, you meet people in court, wherever you meet people, what kind of excuses are people giving you?
So I like to echo a little bit what Mike said, and I think there's a lot of lawyers for a reason we think we know better. Like we went to law school, therefore we know bookkeeping. We went to law school, therefore we know recruiting. We went to law school, therefore we know sales. We went to law school, therefore we know marketing. And that's just an assumption that gets made, I think. And we are very hard individuals to get to that point, to understand that that's not true. And so I told you I was working around the clock because I was doing all of these things, and I thought I was doing it well. Turns out that I totally didn't know what I was talking about. And it took a very big, deep dive personally to understand that that's it. And so having associates and having other people come to the table with their gifts and understanding that we have different trainings, experiences, skills, talents, why not, has been one of the biggest fuels of growth for me in our firm.
Okay, I know of two excuses I got to call you out on.
Okay.
See if you remember these.
Okay.
Remember the year that we had the conversation about that old piece of crap that you used to drive that would break down all the time, and you had a big story about why you had to keep driving that instead of just giving it away and getting a new car?
Right.
What car was that that you were driving? I don't even remember anymore. All I know is it was a piece of crap.
It was a big lifted 2002 Excursion. It was a piece of rust on the bottom, but you know, it was big and the thing is the truck, right? It looked good, so a lot of people would comment on it, and so I liked the association I had with that. But in reality, it was eating me alive. It was not reliable. It drove in circles. It didn't really drive straight on the road. It was always pulling to the left. I mean, there was all sorts of issues with this vehicle. So
what excuses did you make to continue tolerating that truck instead of just getting a new, reliable, safe vehicle?
Do you want the excuse or the real reason?
No, I want to know the excuse that you used to tell people. The excuse that people used to listen to and not call you out on.
The excuse was that it was paid for. Therefore, I didn't have to get into a car loan or a lease or anything else like that. Why would I spend money on something that I already own? That was the excuse, right?
And what was the truth?
The truth is I liked the truck, but I really was petrified on getting into more debt or anything like that. I didn't see value on going and getting something better for me.
And in hindsight, what would you – because I remember we had a big – I mean, we had a big, big, long talk about that. And we talked all about a whole bunch of things. What would you say to your old self about that car now?
Oh, God. Actually, so here is what happened with the whole car. I switched and I got another vehicle, which allowed me to open a second office, drive back and forth in a lot more efficient and reliable way, which blew my entire business. I was holding I tell them, I regret not getting rid of that a lot sooner, right? This old belief that this vehicle was, because it was paid for, they should not be traded in or whatever, it was holding me from a multi-million-dollar business in many ways. Not just that, but it really entitled me or gave me the tools to just be mobile, right?
I think there's a lot of people who will listen to this who will think that the vehicle allowed you to build a multi-million-dollar business. And I think that a lot of people will think about the practical, pragmatic reasons like, oh, you were able to drive, you were able to open a second office.
Uh-huh.
Oh, you know, it didn't break down, so you didn't have to, you know, be late for appointments. You know, all the practical things. But let's get under it and talk about the real reason why that vehicle was holding you back, the mindset around it.
A lot of the change for me happened in a lot of conversations we had to manage about you have to act as if you are already there. So to be, what would the million-dollar business owner do, right? What would be? And a million-dollar business owner would not be driving this kind of truck. The fact that I start making decisions as if I was already there fuel the growth a lot. And I think it wasn't just the truck. It was what I was eating. It was what I was wearing. It was who I was relating to. I start acting as if I was already there, right?
Can I just clarify something? Because I don't want people to misunderstand. This is not a fake it till you make it type of thing. This isn't act as if you already have a $1 million firm. This isn't a put on a show. This is a what decisions would the owner of a $1 million business make? And if you make decisions that are consistent with the decisions that an owner of a $1 million law firm would make, eventually it's inevitable you're going to have to end up with a $1 million business. As long as you continue making decisions that are consistent with the decisions that a $200,000 business owner would make, you're going to continue to recreate a $200,000 business with each of those decisions. I just don't want to have anyone listening to this come away with the idea that this is a act as if, fake it just go get a fancy car. That's not what this is about. It's what it looks like sometimes to the untrained eye, but that's definitely not what's going on here. Hector did not just go out and get a car. He truly changed the way he was relating to his business.
And that's exactly right. That the message is so powerful, but it can easily be misunderstood for, yeah, let me just go get him a bunch of debt or credit card debt just to look good. It wasn't. It was every decision that I made. So I fired my accountant. I got a better accountant. I hired more staff because if obviously I couldn't be doing everything. I hired a better marketing thing. So I really applied it to how I wanted my business to be run. And every decision, I became that owner. And so yes, but it wasn't about being flashy or being into things. It was more about the decision-making process that I was doing.
Okay, and the next thing I got to call you out on is, remember that office you used to have? I called it the armpit office.
Right.
Can you tell everyone about that?
So our office, when we started, it was 580 square feet. 580 square feet, and we have four people working on that. So we were cramped. Now, granted, the office was pretty well laid out.
That's why I called it the armpit office, because I never was there, but I just imagined, you know, everyone being in each other's armpits.
Yes. And so the rent was about $600 a month, right? And it was very, very, very comfortable. I mean, we could barely do anything and make $600, right? It was a terrifying thing for me to just understand, like, oh my gosh, and I started measuring my life on the rent we pay in the office. So, oh, that cost me 2 months of rent. Oh, that cost me 3 months of rent, right? So I didn't want to move because literally the rent was so comfortable for us to make. And so it became a crutch, and we were in that office for 5-6 years. It was when I said, we need to move. Having more physical space, a bigger plant, allowed me to hire more people, bring more associates, and just really grow. So the savings on rent was also keeping me from blowing up the firm, right? But it was comfort. It was that safety net that I felt like no matter what can happen, I could come up with $600 a month at the end of the month, right? You know, again, the Spokane, Washington real estate is pretty inexpensive. But, yes, that's what happened. And so it was Arjun and it was his team going through it and really looking at our numbers and going, like, you got to move. Because I actually was hiring more people into this office and modifying things so I can get more people out of that office. It was when Arjun looked at me and go, like, I remember the exercise. We actually mapped it out on the floor, and you're like, you really need all these people working here. You please don't do that to them.
Yeah, right? I remember that in Coral Gables.
And that was when, yes, and that's when I was like, oh, wow, that's right. So it was comfort. It was just that comfort that I knew I got it. No matter what, I have
so that to was like, it. So that was the excuse. It was comfort.
Yes, he was completely comfortable. It was like, well, it was fear and comfort, right? It's like, what if I double this or triple my expense? How do I know I'm gonna make it, right? So therefore, I don't want to get out of my comfort zone.
So now you have a $3 million firm. Just to finish this up for everyone listening to this, life as the owner of a $3 million law firm as opposed to life as the owner of a $500,000 law firm as compared to life as the owner of a $200,000 law firm. How would you compare and contrast life then versus life in the middle versus life where you're at now?
Life is a lot better. Well, there's just no question about it. It's just the problems I have now, I still have problems. I still have things, but it's just a lot more manageable. My work hours are a lot less. I get to pick a little bit what I want to work on, what problems I want to tackle, and then I have others work on the stuff that I'm either not as good at or I don't really like, right? And in that sense, it's just night and day. Now I have more financial resources that I had in the beginning, so I don't, you know, going to eat with my wife is no longer a decision on price, like I was doing with a rent or I was doing with a vehicle, right? We go out because we want to go out. There's no, so that, in that sense, is great. But there's always issues, right? I still have to work. I still have to push. I'm having to learn other skills, training, motivating, coaching. These are things that I didn't have time to do before. So that's good, but I'm still having to put the work.
Do you still get to practice law if you want to, when you want to?
Yeah, I'm handling two cases that, you know, two files. But I'm not really handling them. They handle it, I just direct it, right? Because they're very cool cases. And so we have a federal complaint on a DACA case for a child that should have been approved and wasn't. And so trying to take a stab at it was really fun, right? Going through discovery with the federal government and just kind of it. And I could have not done that because, you know, there's just no way before. It's a very noble issue of law, and I think that's been really great.
Well, congratulations to you and your family and your team, too, because you're helping, I mean, you're helping, what is it, 200,000 to 3 million.
So we had a little technical difficulty, and then Hector had a client who had arrived for an appointment. So now we are on last and not least, Sarah Hobson. How you doing, Sarah?
Done.
Thank you for your patience.
Doing great. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. Just a little bit about your firm. When did you and Mike start the firm?
Chris and I started it. Well, I started
Chris,
it
I'm
in
sorry.
20.
Mike,
Chris and
Mike
I started
the interview.
It.
I'm sorry.
Yes. Chris, I started it in St. Patrick's Day of 2012, and then by that September, I had asked Chris to leave his firm and come over and join me. And at the time, we were doing both criminal and family law, and I had asked him, he was working at a family law firm, I had asked him to take over the family law cases, and we've been together ever since.
Okay, and what were you doing before you decided to start your own firm?
I was a prosecutor for our county, for the state of Georgia, doing misdemeanor criminal prosecution.
Okay, and what was Chris doing?
Chris was working at a family law firm near locally.
A reputable firm. Good job.
Yes.
Didn't have to leave. Making good money. Doing good work.
Yes. Making really
good
money.
Left at your request.
Yes.
Left at your request.
Exactly, yeah. At the time, basically a little nuance of the law. The law required me to go to a criminal case prior to any family law cases. So a lot of my family law clients were getting upset that I was having to kick their cases and get them rescheduled because I was required to be in court on a criminal case. And it was out of my control. It was just me. So I knew I needed help.
Because you were, because of your work as a prosecutor, you mean?
No, as a criminal defense attorney. So the family law clients were having to get rescheduled because the law required me to go to my criminal clients' cases first. So that was an issue. I knew I needed help. I knew Chris's labor would be free. So I asked him to just, you know, leave his job and come over and take over my family law cases.
Got it. Okay. So what did the firm gross in its first full year? Would that be 2013?
That would be, yeah, 2013. I would have to guess somewhere around 280. My first month out when it was just me, I think I grossed somewhere around 30 grand. I didn't have that. I mean, immediately it was the firm was making money, but I was working 11-hour days. I was, you know, doing several people's work. And so I think it was about 280 in 2013. I'll have to kind of guess, Arjun. I think 2015 was somewhere around 380. 2016 was somewhere around 480, and July of 2017 we joined How to Manage, and we did. We ended up doing about 550 that year.
Okay, and 2018, last year.
2018 we did a little over 1.1 million.
All right. So within 18 months of us working together, the firm basically doubled from 550
right.
to 1.1 million.
Right.
All right. And what are you on track to gross this year in 2019?
We're on track to gross 1.8 million and we're at a $2.2 million run rate. So we had a kind of a slow first quarter, but we're doing much better the last half of the year.
You also bought a house, moved the family, moved into the new house.
Yes.
You know, kind of do some things in life, right?
Yes. I basically, you know, also ran for office. I basically walked away from the firm for about 8 months in 2018.
And so that means Chris was working like a slave while you were gone, or he was able to step away from the business as well?
He helped me as well. He was still working, you know, probably about 35, 40 hours a week in the firm. And I was doing, you know, owner duties as far as checking metrics and checking in with the team and making sure everyone was following the policies and procedures that I had built out with the help of my CEO for about 6 months prior to me stepping away. So it was planned. But no, he was not working like a slave or anything like that, just a normal work week, less than what we were accustomed to working prior to.
So I just want to make sure everyone hears this loud and clear. The firm grew from 1.1 to $1.8 million in a year when you basically shopped for, negotiated, bought, and moved into a beautiful new home,
mm-hmm.
took time off to run for office, and Chris was working 35 to 40 hours a week, not 80 hours a week.
Right.
And what do you say to all the lawyers who will say that's not possible? That didn't really happen. Oh, the only reason she was able to make that happen is because she's left-handed. The only reason that he was able to make that happen is because he's not left-handed. The only reason that that was possible is because of the city they're in, the practice that they do, blah, 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 blah.
I've heard it all. I've even heard rumors that we must be selling drugs. I mean, I've heard every excuse or explanation out there. It's really frustrating. I'm very vocal to everyone I know about what How to Manage has done for us, and I just feel like if I can do this, there's really nothing stopping anyone from doing it. But despite what's right in front of people's faces, and I'm very open about, you know, what we've done, and I believe that there's so much work out there. There's no way I could take all of it to myself anyway. I believe that it's an abundant world. I tell everyone I know about How to Manage, really every attorney that I care about. And it's my experience is met with disbelief, always trying to explain away what we've accomplished. And it's frustrating because I really believe anyone can do this. I mean, anyone with, you know, just being open to playing all in and really putting in the work. I mean, the example I use, it's not like you buy a membership at a gym and you suddenly lose 40 pounds. Like, you've got to show up and do the work. But it's really sad. I think a lot of people, when I'm telling them, hey, you know, you're complaining about this, you know, you're working too much, you never get to see your kids, there's help out there where you can truly have your business make money and you don't have to be working in it every day. And it's, yeah, it's, I mean, exactly what you said. That would never work for me. It must be your practice area. But having made many friends within How to Manage, I know it's nothing unique to our circumstance. I've seen people in every practice area be able to do what we've done. And all, you know, very small cities are able to do what we've done. So I, you know, it is frustrating, I guess I would say.
And then, of course, people in big cities say that it's easier in small cities or small towns where there's less competition. And people
right.
in small towns say it's easier in big cities where there's more people. And,
right.
you know, everyone's got a reason. So the things you're saying that people are telling you that essentially dismiss it or, you know, that will work for you, but that wouldn't work for me, I call those excuses.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that what they are?
Absolutely, yeah.
What are some of your favorites that you hear? Tell me, okay, you got to tell me about the drug thing. Don't tell me the name of the person, obviously.
It was just a rumor that got back to me that there was a thought that perhaps we were selling drugs. We didn't understand how we could have doubled and then doubled. You know, it, I mean, it's everyone has certainly taken notice of our growth. And, you know, we went from a 1,000-square-foot office to a 5,000-square-foot office with another 5,000 square feet above us once we require more space. When I talked to people, I talked to someone this morning, a good friend of mine, and he said, I don't know if I'm cut out for that. You know, he's still doing his own taxes and all that. And really nice guy. And I'm telling him, you know, there's another way. There's a better way. But it's just this just completely shut off, just completely closed to the idea that you can get help. And I think that's really how I was before I found How to Manage. I wasn't, you know, you were talking to Mike about his awareness of what was going to fall apart. And I think I was so into the wheel. I was spinning the wheel so hard and I was grinding so hard. The thought didn't even cross my mind. I thought this was the price of success. And the sad thing is that I was willing to pay it. And, I mean, my plan was just to keep working more. And, I mean, I was working 11-hour days. Well, I could work 12-hour days. I could work, you know, that was my plan. I had never, you know, that's where I was at. It's just completely closed off to it. So I do talk to people like that, and I try to let them know that there's help out there. It doesn't have to be that way. And there's some people that they will open their minds to it, and there's some people that I think, you know, maybe I'm not doing a good job of explaining it, but they're at that moment they're closed off to it. You know, they don't.
You know what?
I can show them my bank account, and they wouldn't believe me.
We're not doing a good job of it, and by we, I mean obviously I've been doing this. You know, I created How to Manage a Small Law Firm in 2009. This is now 10 years that we've been doing this. We've gone from the first year that I ran How to Manage a Small Law Firm, we only grossed $75,000. This year we'll gross $15 million. The things that I complain about today, my biggest problems in my business and my biggest problems in my household today are the things that I used to fantasize about back then. I used to fantasize about my problems today. And we've now have 400 solo and small law firms all over the country. And I mean, every one of you, the three of you all told the same basic story about going from hundreds of thousands of dollars to over $1 million in revenue and working less and having more freedom and being able to help more people and less stress and better lives. And I mean, we just have like hours and hours and hours of case studies and testimonials and teleseminars like this, and yet there will be lawyers who will listen to this, and they still won't do anything.
Right.
You know, we have a virtual boot camp that we created about a year ago, and it's been very, very effective. It's only, you know, like $600 or $700. It's like practically free. It comes with 100% money back guarantee. They don't even have to leave their house to do it. And at the end, after they've worked with us for 4 weeks to really turn their business around and start to get a taste of what it's all about, then they can come to a free 2-day bonus workshop and meet hundreds of you guys in the flesh to really find out that this is real, get a taste of what the experience is like being a member of How to Manage a Small Law Firm. And still, you know, hundreds of lawyers every quarter will listen to that offer and then won't take action. So, you know, people love their excuses. They love their comfort. They love their stories. What are some of the other, rumors about that you must be selling drugs? I'm going to discount that. Like, what are some of the other things people really tell you about why you can do it but they can't, or why they won't do it? You know, what are some of the excuses that you hear?
Another one I hear is, we've had success because we're a husband-wife partner, and that they could, you know, they could never work with their spouse, or their spouse doesn't have the training or the background, the education to do what we do in this program with How to Manage. Another excuse is they really just want to be a really good attorney. That's all that they care about. Despite the fact that everything that they're complaining about has nothing to do with how much they're practicing law. I mean, they're talking about missing out on their kids. They're talking about not being able to afford anything, always being in a perpetual cash crunch. But they think that, you know, it's really important to them to be, you know, recognized as just the best attorney in town. And they think that this would interfere with that. They're not cut out for it. Some people, I think.
Let me ask you, did you think, and I really want you to give this a thought before you just answer. Do you think that you're a better lawyer today with a $2 million law firm than you were with a $400,000 law firm?
Absolutely. The things that I was focusing on when we were a $400,000 law firm, I did not have the bandwidth to be a great attorney. I did my best with the time that I had, but I mean, I was working myself down to the bone. I mean, it was bad. My husband landed in the hospital twice with heart issues, and I'm 34 right now, so this was, you know, 3-4 years ago when it started. We were, of course, focused on giving great legal representation, but we had a lot of external factors that were also demanding our attention. And there was decisions that were being made based on whether or not we were going to get paid. And we have policy, we have a system in place for getting paid, where if we're not going to be getting paid, it's my position that it's unethical to continue to represent someone, so we don't. So we have a system so that we can get them in touch with another attorney, but we're not going to be advising clients when our attorneys are concerned whether or not they're going to be getting paid for the case. It's not the same advice that you give. I don't care what you say. It's the headspace that we have, what we think is possible, even for our clients, is so different. We're focused on what the client's goals are. You know, from the beginning, we're asking them what their goals are. We're making sure that they're a good fit, that their goals are aligned with what our firm, what we view our vision and our mission and what we're trying to, the impact we're trying to make on our community, so that we can really get behind the clients. Before, it was kind of a cookie cutter representation. This is, we do this and then we do this. We never really asked the clients what they wanted, what their goals were, what they would consider to be a success. And it's not always case related. You know, it's, we go deeper than that. So, I mean, absolutely, I feel that I'm a better lawyer now. I'm a different person. I can hardly recognize myself in the way I used to think, in the way I used to make decisions. And I still have so far to go. You know, that's the awesome thing is, I mean, I'm still always trying to grow and improve my personal mindset. And that's something I didn't even, I mean, I'd never used that word before. That was not even on my radar. It was just, you know, just running in this wheel, just perpetually running and grinding and always worried about getting the next case in and how, you know, I got to close this case because my, you know, my bandwidth was beyond its max capacity. I don't know, and objectively, anyone who could look at me then and look at me now and say that it was better then.
You know, Zig Ziglar used to say, and I'm going to paraphrase this, and then I'm going to change it. He used to say that the best part of becoming a millionaire is who you have to become in order to become a millionaire.
Right.
And I'm going to paraphrase it and say, the best part of building a multi-million dollar law firm is who you have to become and all the people you have to help in order to have a multi-million dollar law firm. Because look at how many more people you're able to help and how many more resources you're able to bring to bear and how you're able to show up as a better, more focused, less stressed out, less distracted version of yourself now as mm-hmm. compared to who you were then.
Oh, yeah.
It's spectacular.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
And yet there are lawyers out there who have every excuse in the book for why you can do it, why Mike and Allison can do it, why Hector can do it, why hundreds of our other members from all walks of life, black, white, Asian, Hispanic, male, female, in their 30s, in their 40s, in their 50s, even in their 60s and beyond, getting started to get their law firm under control. Different practice areas, big cities, small towns, why they can do it, but
right.
somehow the person who's sitting comfortably in their stories and excuses can't.
Mm-hmm.
And I just yep. wish for them that they would get out of their own way.
Right. Yep.
Last question, and then I'm going to wrap this thing up.
All right.
Two or three examples, concrete, practical, tangible examples of how you believe your law firm is able to help your clients more today than it was back when you were burning the candle at both ends.
One would be, the whole machine doesn't stop if I get sick or a child gets sick. I feel back then a client's case and the progression of their case was completely dependent on me and me alone. And if something happened to me, sorry, you know, this
or one
yeah,
of your
took
kids.
Or one of my kids, you know, this it took us months to get you this court date, and now we're gonna have to move it and postpone resolution of your case because I'm the only person who can do anything with your case. It's really sad because that happened. I mean, it happened on more, I have four children. I mean, it happened on more than one occasion. The other thing is there were, I think at that time, you know, we were so focused on, you know, we got to get in another case. We were taking in really toxic people, that it affected us, but we tolerated it because we thought that's what we needed to do. You know, we would take in, you know, people who we'd find over the course of representation, their intentions were not good. You know, perhaps they're using the child as a pawn and they're upset that their ex has found someone new, so they're going to really stick it to them with their custody case. And it really wore on us. I mean, those clients require the majority of your attention and your blood, sweat, and tears. And I think it detracted from our ability to really focus on other clients. Those clients tend to be the squeaky wheels. And now that we have
and those kind of clients are the ones, and those are the kind of clients who also screw up all your marketing because
right.
It's just like it's just like accelerating towards a brick wall. It's like I just don't want to suffer anymore.
and yet more crappy clients are coming in the door. And since I don't have a good enough marketing machine, I don't have the courage to turn them down.
Right. And now, I mean, we have, you know, two associates were filling the position of our third, and they are empowered to let us know if there's someone who we're representing. Because sometimes, you know, we have gatekeepers, but sometimes a toxic person will get through to notify us so that we can start the disengagement process, because it's not, you know, this firm, we really do want to make an impact. We want to make a positive impact, and we don't want to be pushing a position in front of a judge when it's, you know, it's very clear that they do not intend to do anything in the best interest of their child. It affects the firm's reputation. And I mean, quite frankly, I just feel like crap thinking about it. You know, I don't want to help that person. And now we're in a position where we know that it's very important to focus on who we're engaging and, you know, who the firm is servicing. So that would be my second example.
And, you know, I just want to add and say, it's not fair to the good clients when you represent crappy clients, because then they wear you out, and then you show up as less than the best version of yourself for the good client who really deserves you at your best.
Right. And, you know, when you go in front of a judge, it's important that they know that you're advocating truly because you believe in helping that client, and that you're not just making whatever argument you need to make some money. I think that goes a long way, and I've heard that feedback from judges in our county. Another tangible, you know, we've also been able to, as we've grown, we've got an awesome team working for us. So there's, you know, many families that are impacted by the firm's growth, and that they have employment, and we are a team here. You know, they've got colleagues. They feel like they're through the firm's goals and mission. They're also accomplishing and meeting their goals and their professional desires, and that's really neat. I mean, that was another thing that wasn't even on my radar. I never thought that I would be hiring people and having a team, and what we're able to do, you know, when the whole team pulls together. You know, emergencies happen, and there was a death in the family for one of the associates. Chris and I were out of the country, and everyone just pulled together and made sure that client didn't even experience a blip at all on their case that was going to court that week. So that was really cool because, you know, back in the day, before, you know, hiring How to Manage, that would not have happened. It would have been a disaster, and we would have been, you know, they would have blasted us on the internet. And, you know, it's just a completely different experience now.
Or you certainly would have had to cut your vacation short.
Oh yeah, no, we would have been flying back for sure. Yeah, that would have been the end of it. I mean, we've you know, that's happened where we never would go out of the country before, but you know, we've had to end a trip short to get back and put out a fire. Or, you know, work through vacations so that you're coming back more tired than when you left. We've done that too.
Yeah. How was your vacation? Mommy was on the phone the whole time.
Right. Sadly, that happened. That used to be our normal.
Yeah. It's the normal for too many people who make too many excuses.
Mm-hmm.
So, listen, I appreciate you taking the time out of your day to do this for me and to try to pay it forward and try to encourage other lawyers to step up, take all their excuses and shove them up their ass and really do something here. I need to make an offer to everyone who's on the line and just let you know that there's an opportunity to get enrolled in the next virtual boot camp. And that is going to be a 4-week virtual boot camp. You do it from the comfort of your own home or office. You don't have to travel anywhere. It's all by telephone, not even webinars. So you don't have to like be sitting in front of a computer, just be on a phone. We send you all the work, all the recordings to listen to in your car when you're driving around. So you listen while you're driving around instead of sitting in traffic listening to the news. You'll sit in the car and listen and learn. And then every week there is about a 3 or 4 hour highly, highly, highly interactive workshop style meeting. There's homework to do. You're making tangible, measurable progress each and every week for 4 consecutive weeks. At the end of that, you'll be invited to participate in a live 2-day workshop. That live 2-day workshop, you take all the work you've done for the previous 4 weeks and you put it all together and you revise it all and you come away with a really great business plan, maybe the first business plan you've ever had in your whole time running a law firm. While you're at the live workshop, you'll have the opportunity to meet hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of our members like Sarah, Hector, and Mike, and hundreds of their peers who are members of How to Manage a Small Law Firm. And you can talk to them and talk to their spouses and talk to their significant others and bring your spouse or significant other with you. And at the end of that 2-day workshop, if we have space, you may decide to engage our services. If we don't have space, you can go on the waiting list. But this 4-week virtual boot camp, it's less than $1,000. It comes with a 100% money-back guarantee. You don't have to even get 100% of it to make it much, much, much worth more than what you invest in it. And I really can't think of a single reason why anyone wouldn't want to check that out. To learn more about that, go to howtomanage.com/better2020, www.howtomanage.com/better2020. There's limited space to engage our services at all, and there's limited space to get into the next virtual boot camp because of the highly interactive nature of it. So don't miss out. Go to www.howtomanage.com/better2020 today. Hector had to drop. Mike, Sarah, thank you both so much for participating. And that brings part 2 of this 3-part series, The Truth and Nothing But the Truth About Starting, Growing, and Running a Really Successful Law Firm, to a conclusion. Thank you both for your time.
Thank you.
Thanks, Arjun.